we wanted to create a model that was much more about getting people to open up and be more vulnerable, and to get people who are really on the same page about wanting an intentioned relationship and are willing to invest more in their profiles, willing to be more selective, and willing to take the process slower. So I just didn't think we could get to that from where we were. And so I went to my board and I just said, listen, gross leveling out. Like, I don't think that we are gonna, Tinder is its own thing at this point. We're not trying to be that. There's this big opportunity, I think, to be the app for relationships. Like, all those people who signed up to this app now 4 years ago are getting older. Older people are starting to get on the dating apps and they're looking for something more serious, and it's not designed to that for that. So let's find an app that's really designed for helping people find relationships.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Justin McLeod is the founder of Hinge, the dating app which was acquired by Match Group in 2018. Hinge differentiates itself as an app focused on in-depth ways of forming relationships, with the mantra, designed to be deleted. McLeod founded Hinge based on his own powerful romantic journey, which borders on a real-life fairy tale. Not only does McLeod detail his entrepreneurial and romantic story, but he also shares his ups and downs in a remarkably authentic manner. His openness and honesty allowed us to begin our conversation by talking about the subject of addiction, a topic which many struggle with, and one that Justin has been very public about.
Diving right into it.
Why not? Let's
Tell
go right to
your
it, man.
Deepest, darkest times and secrets, just to open things up. So it's a complicated question, but I think that high level, my experience was fun and games until it wasn't fun and games anymore. You know, once upon a time, it was just about being the party kid and then really enjoying going out and partying. And then it just became a bigger and bigger part of my life. And the rest of my life shrunk down further and further and further till it felt like I just didn't have control anymore. And what was interesting is that my experience with addiction was that it's more subtle than I think I imagine it to be, or that other people maybe looking from the outside in about addiction imagine it to be. They imagine this, like, I don't want to drink, but like the drink's coming up to my, you know, I just can't stop myself. And it very much wasn't that. It was this insidious kind of, you know, I'd wake up in the morning thinking I never wanted to do it again. But then by the evening, I'd be like, well, but like, you know, but people are going out, it wasn't that bad. And it was just this kind of inner civil war with myself that was just really torturous over time. And what I looked at, what really got me to the end and made me realize I didn't want to keep going is that it was this feeling like the steering wheel to my life was broken. It's like I had these goals and this vision of where I wanted my life to go, and I wanted to have great relationships, and then I wanted to have a great career. But every day when I looked at my behavior, it wasn't really the type of behavior that was going to stack up to that long term, despite being a pretty crafty and a person who could, you know, get his way through most things. In the end, the addiction was stronger than I was.
Was there a low point that really made you change, you know, hitting kind of a bottom where you just said, look, I need to change this behavior if I want to get all those things kind of you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a typical type of bottom. I think that the thing that mattered to me most at the time was just ambition and wanting to have a great career. And despite being hospitalized multiple times and all kinds of really bad disciplinary things that had happened to me, the thing that really got me is that I didn't get the job that I wanted at Goldman Sachs investment banking division. And I was like, my life is off track. I have to put it back together. And it was, I mean, the day I stopped was the day I graduated from college, and I was headed down to Washington, D.C. to take this other job that I didn't really want. And that was kind of when I had that steering wheel kind of analogy come to me. And I was just like, I feel like I'm done. I remember thinking to myself, I don't really know what the point of life is if it's not to drink and party, but I'm going to try to find out.
Yeah. And you certainly, I'm sure, have along the way. And it sounds like when you came out of school, you wanted to get into investment banking. Was that always something you wanted?
No, I didn't even know what that was, honestly. I still don't, in a way. So, no, I think I grew up, at least I am such a product of my environment and my influences. And my dad was an entrepreneur and had his own company. It was a flooring distribution company in Kentucky. So I had that side of me. And then my mom actually worked for him for a long time. And then when she was almost 40 years old, she went back to law school and became a lawyer and then a prosecutor and then later a judge. And so there's a piece of me that was interested in the law and debate and politics. And there's a piece of me that was interested in entrepreneurship. So I was kind of all over the place. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then when I was at school, mathematical economics was sort of the most prestigious kind of major that you could have. It was the most complex major that you could have at Colgate. So I just gravitated towards that. And then everyone who's a math econ major gravitated towards investment banking. And so I was just kind of going along with the flow.
Yeah. It sounded like though to want to go to Goldman and knowing Goldman and being such a high level investment firm, was there always this drive in you to kind of want to be the best?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think I was probably driven by some sense of wanting to prove myself for a long time. It actually kind of ties to the side of me that wanted to start Hinge eventually, which was that I'm not sure how ambitious a kid I was, frankly, until around middle school. And I had this girlfriend that I was totally in love with who broke up with me. And I was so heartbroken. It came as a total surprise. And we'd been little boyfriend, girlfriend for 3 years. And it hurt me so bad. And I was I'm never going to let that happen again. I'm never going to let that happen again. And so I think I really turned to perfectionism and wanting to be this proving myself and proving that I'm worth it to everyone and this kind of invulnerability. And so I think that drove honestly a lot of it.
Yeah, I can certainly relate and certainly understand so many successful entrepreneurs who have built incredible businesses. Unfortunately, it could come from a place like that, which is so great for a business, but obviously for a personal life, it can become very difficult. So how old were you when this girl broke up with you? What was her name? What happened to her?
I was 13. I don't know. Who knows what happened to her? But I was 13 years, I was in seventh grade. So 13 years old, I guess. And our families were good friends with each other and we used to travel, go to trips together. And then one day she turned around in English class and just was like, it's over. And it was just a shock to my system. And it really was, when I look back at my life, I wasn't that ambitious a kid. I think it really something in my brain, it was traumatic to me. And it just clicked. And I was I'm never gonna let that happen again. And I think the level of ambition, and I was president of the student government in my middle school then at the eighth grade. And then I was president of the student government in high school and captain of the tennis team and graduation speaker. Meanwhile, I obviously had this huge addiction and party side as well. But yeah, I think I was really fueled by ambition. And I was fueled by ambition when I, went on and went to Harvard Business School and when I started Hinge, honestly. But it's changed. The journey over the last 10 years, that it's definitely changed a lot.
I'd love to hear how it changed, but I want to ask you, how did it start? How did Hinge start?
Well, it started over another heartbreak. So it started over...
These heartbreaks are really good for you, actually.
So that one was... So I really never dated anyone seriously again after that. All through high school, it was just it was just about the chase. And then as soon as things got messy or vulnerable or whatever, I just was out of there and moving on to the next thing. And then my sophomore year of college, I'd just gotten out of rehab. I had to spend the whole summer in rehab in order to even be able to come back after my first year. And I, sort of met Kate, the most archetypically opposite person to me, right? Never had a drink, never kissed a boy, came from Catholic school, just come to Colgate. It was her first day ever. First year, and she'd gotten there early in order to do volunteer work. And, just hugely different human being than me. And she found me passed out on a stairwell after my first year. That first day of my second year. And from celebrating my release from rehab. And that was our first interaction. We had a few better interactions later on, and we just had this really amazing connection that turned into this on and off relationship all through college. And at the end of college, shortly after, we just went our separate ways. I was still in my addiction phase. And I think that what I realized is that she was better off without me. So I was like, I really think you need to move on. And like, we can talk again one day maybe, but you just have to move on. So she did. And she actually went and got the job at Goldman that she knew I wanted and didn't get. And then she met a guy there and moved with him to London. And that's kind of what I knew. And I was heartbroken, but I wouldn't reach out to her because I knew we had a really special connection, but I also knew that like, if I reached out to her, maybe she'd come back and then I would screw it up again. I was like, the best thing I can do for this person is just to stay out of her life. And that was true for 4 years. And then I was in Harvard Business School and I'd gotten a job at McKinsey and I've been sober for 4 years. And I was like, okay, do we think we can like reach back out to Kate now? And I didn't really like know where it would go. And I wrote her this kind of amends letter where I like, you know, I'm really, really sorry for the way that I acted and who I was at that time. I've changed a lot. I don't know how I ever could make it up to you, but I would love to try. And she responded and we actually agreed to meet up back in New York that Thanksgiving. And then she called the next day and she was like, listen, Justin, like, I just can't, I'm with this guy, we have a life. And in my head, I always thought deep down that we were going to end up back together. And then it became clear that we weren't, like, it was over. And there was seemingly no chance that we were going to get back together. And I was at business school and it was just awkward for me because business school is like a big party, like crowd and people, that's how people connect, is drinking and partying. And I wasn't doing that. And so it was hard for me to meet new people. And I had stunted social skills as someone who relied on getting drunk to be able to like hang out with people. So, you know, I looked at like dating websites and this is 2011, very different time. People my age did not use dating websites. You did not want to be like caught dead, you know, like on a dating website in 2011 as a 27-year-old. But I had this idea that if you could make it about friends of friends and you could make it a really easy sign-on process that connected you to Facebook, that use your Facebook profile and all your photos and your name and all you had to do is kind of just click a button, then you could crack open this market among all the single people in their 20s that weren't using dating websites at the time. So that was the insight, that was the thought. So I just like got to work on it. I was just obsessed with it. I'd been working on, at that point, I was dabbling in the idea of wanting to be an entrepreneur, even though I'd accepted a job at McKinsey. But I was like, you know, there's a piece of me that really wants to run a company. But every idea I worked on, it felt like homework. It felt, you know, I'd sit down and I'd try to work on the idea, but it just wasn't, there's like no, I was like motoring through it as like best I could, but it just, and then all of a sudden when this idea hit me, it was like a sailboat and just like a gale force wind. It was just like, it's all I could think about and all I could do. And I just felt driven by this idea. I just felt driven to bring this idea into the world. So I like, it's almost like I didn't have a choice.
I love that you just said that. I wrote a book about 10 years ago that I think like 5 people read, but there was this thing in there. It's about young entrepreneurs. And I said, there's a homework test. If it feels like homework for you, then it's not right. But if you're waking up and you're like, shit, this is amazing, like I'm really passionate about this, then you know you have something there. And for you at the start of this, so were you a developer? Were you building the app? Did you hire someone? How did you get going?
I did code as a kid, so I knew enough to be kind of dangerous. I could talk to engineers well. I understood object-oriented programming. I understood generally how the interfaces worked, and I understood the difference between a front end and a back end and all that. But I wasn't really like proficient enough to code this thing from scratch in a way that was good. So I raised a little bit of money. I had like $12,000. That was actually my McKinsey signing bonus. And there was another friend at school who had some money, and we pooled it together and we hired some engineers in Argentina to help us build the original prototype. So it was like a very basic spec of how this thing would work. And they helped us build that original prototype. Then I then took around to VCs to say like, this is how it works. This is how it would work.
How'd you find the guys in Argentina, or why were they in Argentina? Was that just
there were these services at the time. I don't even remember the names of them, but it was basically like, it was early days of the gig economy, and you could find engineers who could help you work on projects on this sort of network hub. I forget the name of it, but there were like two big ones at the time. And so it was on there.
What was the process like for you in terms of going out then once you had this prototype and raising capital?
Well, it was pretty tough. No one really listened to me. I would pitch VCs on it and they would say, yeah, but Match.com and they own this market, and how are you going to disrupt them? And there wasn't a lot of, I really was like, market is not saturated. Like, the market is not saturated because all my friends, none of them use a dating app or a dating website at the time. And so I'm like quite certain this isn't saturated, and you just have to find a way to open it up. And like, oh, well, they'll just copy you if you can figure that out. But they just didn't get the idea that, like, really, if you're going to create a mobile first, social first app, it would really be a different paradigm and a different brand, and it would appeal to a whole new group of people. So that's what I kept telling them. And I was able to raise money in the hundreds of thousands based on that eventually, after having, I don't know how many meetings, 50 VC meetings and 50, and mainly like angel, like a lot of angels and a lot of my parents just trying to get someone to give me a little bit of money.
Yeah.
So I was able to scrape together like a couple rounds of 100,000, but it was really tough. I'll say it was really, really tough.
How hard was that for you personally, the rejection, when you would hear the no's?
I think it was frustrating, but it didn't bring me self-doubt, if that makes any sense. Because I had like a thesis that was like, no, it just needs a one-click sign-on and it needs to be connected to Facebook and it needs a new brand. And they weren't really like engaging with the like argument of the first principles of why, you know, why dating sites have stigmas, because you have to fill out a long profile and pay lots of money, and people who don't want to, like, you don't want to do that unless you really struggle in your dating life, and no one wants to admit they struggle in their dating life. That's why people who are in their 20s don't use it. And if you could create this really simple sign-on process that would make it like so easy, it's like, why wouldn't you do it? That would open up the market. That was the central thesis. And they were just like, yeah, dating sites, I don't know. It was just really tough to get someone to actually like engage on the substance of the argument. So I was frustrated that they wouldn't do that, but it didn't make me not convinced that this was definitely going to be a thing. And then the argument stopped because Tinder came along and it was no longer a question.
And in terms of Tinder and people seeing that, is that when they started opening up their wallets, these VCs, or were you able to scratch?
Yeah, then it swung to the opposite extreme, where we raised a $14 million round and I was turning away millions of dollars because you couldn't invest in Tinder. It was owned by IAC. And I don't think anyone dreamed it was going to get as big as it would, where it would completely envelop the market cap of IAC. But no one could invest in it. So we were, at that point, the only really game in town. And we did have a different vibe, right? We were friends of friends connected to Facebook based on your social connections, not just like random people nearby. And so we had our niche. We had like how we were starting. And so we had it. It was a nice counterpoint to Tinder, and we had the market proven out for us. So then it was very easy to raise money.
Yeah. Seems like it was more of a kind of long-term relationship approach than maybe Tinder, where it's like, I haven't been on, unfortunately. I mean, unfortunately, I've been married for 15 years, so I wouldn't really know. I mean, like, I was on JDate back in 1998, I'll tell you that. But anyway, I would imagine, though, that with Hinge, it seems to me, especially going through Facebook and friends of friends, that it was more real in terms of the relationship.
Yeah, we definitely had more of a relationship-y vibe. It felt more like a house party or a wedding or a dinner party meeting someone versus like a club.
Right. And whatever happened to Kate?
Well, so a few years later, Hinge, you know, after we'd raised money and things had started to get kind of big, I did a interview with a reporter who wanted to write a story on me and Hinge because she had downloaded it and matched with the very first guy who came up for her and had fallen in love with him. And she's like, how did you, like, how is it possible that I download this app and you immediately know who my person is? And which, it was dumb luck. Like, we're not that good. We're good. We're not that good. So anyway, we sit down for this article, and at the end of it, she was like, "Have you ever been in love?" And I said, "Well, once a long time ago, but I didn't realize it until it was too late." She's like, "Well, tell me the story." And I told her the story of Kate and our relationship and the twists and turns, and you know how she had really been the inspiration for Hinge in the first place when I got my heart broken and didn't like know what to do. And she turns off the tape recorder and she's like, "Listen, I have to tell you a story." And so she had this story that's very similar to mine, where this long lost love that she got back together with and saw 20 years later after she'd been married and had her kids, that they found each other 20 years later, and it made her realize that like that kind of love is possible, and that it actually made her leave her marriage, which is then when she downloaded Hinge. And so she was like, don't get me wrong, I love my life, I love my kids, but I just like, you have a chance to be with the one, like you can go be with the one, like you, it's not over. And I'm like, lady, it's over. Like it's been 7 years, almost eight at that point, about 8 years since I'd seen Kate, and she lived somewhere else and was engaged to be married. And she's like, "Well, you'll never know if you don't try." And about a month later, I was headed over to London for the Hinge launch party in the UK, where I thought she lived. So I just sent her one last email, and Deborah was in my head, and I was like, "All right." I sent her one last, because I'd written her, by the way, after she turned me down. I'd write her once a year on her birthday, and she never responded. So I was just like, it's pretty over. And in fact, the last one that I'd sent in 2013, I said I'd come over with an engagement ring, and then I'd gotten like defriended on Facebook and like blocked on Instagram. So it was like pretty clear that it was over. But I was headed over to the London launch party. I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to send one last email. And so I said, "Gonna be in London. Weird to think I'm never gonna see you again. Would love 15 minutes just to say hi and goodbye." And I woke up the next morning and I had a response back. And she's like, "Listen, obviously my fiance, not a huge fan of yours. Also, you're a horrible stalker. I live in Switzerland, but I'll be around this weekend if you want to give a call. He's going on a trip and we can chat on the phone and just say hi." And so I said, "Okay."
Yep.
And then I hopped on a plane to Switzerland immediately. And then the next morning she texted me and she said, "Hey, you know, I'm up. When you're ever ready to chat, we can chat." And I said, "Great, because I'm going through customs in Zurich right now. And so where should we meet?" And anyway, we met up, we sat down for coffee, realized that we both just knew that we really wanted to be together. And that was it. And so she called off her wedding. She flew back to America, and I'd say happily ever after. Let me tell you, it sounds like a fairy tale, and it, don't get me wrong, like it was, Kate is absolutely, like, she's the love of my life. I adore her, but we hadn't seen each other in 8 years, and she moved into my 340 square foot apartment in the West Village. And then we were two people living together, figuring each other out. And that's when I think I really started to learn what a relationship is all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. So I assume then now you guys are still together, and
we are. We got married in 2017.
Oh.
And then in February 2017. So I've married for 4 years now and some change. And have a little son, Oliver, who's almost two.
So, yeah. Got it. Living the dream.
Yeah. I mean, it feels good. It, we're in a good spot.
That's awesome. Sure. So talking about Hinge, so you raise the initial money. Of course, people start coming after you. What is it that, when was it when you realized, wow, this, we're really building something here that people are using and liking?
Well, I had that feeling, sort of. And it was, so I raised all that money in December 2014. And 2015, we continued to grow, but like towards the end of the year, things started to level off a little bit. And I felt like the sentiment really start to turn in the market. And then this article got published in Vanity Fair about, you know, the dawn of the dating apocalypse and how dating apps were ruining romance. And we were just turning into this like hookup culture where people just became disposable. And I had to admit that like, that was kind of true. And it really made me sit back and just be like, this is not what I created this company for. This is not what, you know, And we just gotten so focused on our competition and so focused on all the VC metrics and engagement and retention and all these like time on app and all that stuff. And we just gotten away from the soul of why I started the company in the first place. And also, by the way, Kate had come back right about that time as well. And so I was learning that I really thought dating was a numbers game. I really thought that you just had to go through enough people and eventually you'd find your perfect person. And here I had like gotten my perfect person. And then what I realized was that it's not about like, it's still, you know, it's hard on the other side of that too. And it's not about that. It's not about waiting until you have your perfect puzzle piece and then everything's smooth sailing from there. Relationships are really hard work and it's about how you approach them. And I think that the model of dating apps at that time and the model that Hinge was modeled after was basically modeled after this fantasy rom-com of like, oh, like the meet cute and then everything's simple from there. And we wanted to create a model that was much more about getting people to open up and be more vulnerable and to get people who are really on the same page about wanting an intentioned relationship and are willing to invest more in their profiles, willing to be more selective and willing to take the process slower. And so I just didn't think we could get to that from where we were. And so I went to my board and I just said, listen, gross leveling out. Like, I don't think that we are gonna, Tinder is its own thing at this point. We're not trying to be that. There's this big opportunity, I think, to be the app for relationships. Like all those people who signed up to this app now 4 years ago are getting older. Older people are starting to get on the dating apps and they're looking for something more serious and it's not designed to that for that. So let's find an app that's really designed for helping people find relationships. That's eventually our tagline, designed to be deleted, but is designed to get you off the app because you're really looking for your person and we can help you zero in on that. So that was the pitch and that's what we did. So we, and that was, let me tell you, it was like pretty tough. We had 30 people on the team and it was clear that we couldn't be burning that much cash of paying 30 people to start over from scratch. So I had to cut the team in half and take that group of people and inspire them that we were going to head in a different direction now and that I really wanted them all to come along. And, you know, scarily, like I didn't know the answer. Like I knew that I hope that there's something other model out there other than the swipe feature that's going to work for a dating service, but I don't know what that looks like. And we just have to figure it out together. And I trust that we will. And so that was the decision back in end of 2015, going into 2016. We spent all of 2016 building this new thing and released it at the end of 2016. And yeah, now it's starting to feel like it's a thing. Yeah, it happens so gradually and over 10 years, it's funny. It's just, it's like the frog in the pot. Like, is it a thing? Like, is it a big thing? I think it feels like it's starting to be a big thing, but I don't know. I've just been in here working the whole time. So it's hard to,
We've got you on this show. So it's called How Success Happens. So we definitely think some success happened here for sure. And I think it's interesting how personally you could, it's amazing. We get so many entrepreneurs on this show and they're in their worlds and, you know, not even realizing how successful they've been. But for you, changing directions at that time, were there times you were almost like, I don't know if I could do this? Or was it still kind of waking up and having that passion?
Oh, no. I was like practically suicidal in the middle of it. I mean, I definitely in the middle of it, I was like, I totally made a mistake. Like, this was the wrong thing. We should have just kept going with what we were doing, you know, like at least we had momentum. Yeah. It felt like Moses leading people around the desert. We were just like trying to figure things out that were working, but nothing, like we'd try something and it wouldn't, and it was just, people were looking to me like, where are we going? What are we doing? And I don't know, you know, but I did have some structure and some like, you know, we wanted to get rid of the swipe feature. We wanted to create something that created more signal and less noise. We wanted to like remove gamification. So we had like a set of principles, but figuring out like truly what was the design that was going to come out of this was non-trivial, but we finally hit on something around like June, July that year. Of the idea of getting liking something about someone using the liking content and not, you know, and delivering that like every time so that you didn't like people to see if they liked you back. There was no double opt-in. It was just, you like someone, we send through the like. And that dynamic, as simple as it sounds, and making mandatory prompts and photos that you had to have at least like three prompts where you answer these short questions that are designed to help you get into conversation. And so it did a few things that were really important. One is it filtered out like 30% of people on the front end who didn't want to do that, which was great because on their old app, you'd hit a button and 100% of people got in. And frankly, like if you're not willing to like six photos and three prompts and fill out some more information about yourself, then you're probably like not really looking for a relationship. So that was great. And then the other thing it did is it made people way more selective in who they were liking on the platform, because no longer were you just tossing people to the left and the right. If you like someone, you had to choose something about it. You had the option to say something. And so suddenly the sort of like rate went from like 50 something percent down to like 10 or 15%. And again, you could look at that as like, if you're looking about engagement, retention, time on app, like that's horrible. Like that would be a disastrous outcome. But for us, we're like, no, like this is means we're getting good signal. I took you out and I was like, help me understand your type. And every other person on the street, you said, yeah, that's my type. That's I would really have a like pretty poor indication of your type. And also you're doing it just based on a photo or based on how they look. Whereas sitting people down, interviewing them, and you're telling me one out of every 10 people is your type. Now I've got a sense. Now I can start designing my algorithm in a way that really is going to help you find your person. And then the third piece about delivering every single like means that we've got to be really thoughtful about who we show to you. We definitely want to show you people you're interested in, but we also can't flippantly just show you someone who's completely out of your league. Because if we did that a lot, then that person would just get overwhelmed with likes. So we really got to keep you focused on the people that we think are going to be a good match for you versus just showing you a bunch of super hot people that you can like, but that doesn't actually do anything for you or for them.
Right. And then how did you know? I mean, it sounds obviously in terms of the business, the metrics, and you know, it's working, right? Because people are engaged and the ones that really are, it sounds like they're having success. So was that when you first really, like, when was it when you really noticed that this turnaround, this flip was the right thing to have done?
Well, slow at first, but we had set a new North Star metric, right? It's no longer growth or engagement. It was number of great first dates. And we're still the only app that even asks whether our users go on a date and whether it was good or not. So we were measuring that and we're like, how many likes, how much engagement, how many likes you have to send in order to get to a date. And on the old version of Hinge, the answer was 1,000. You had to send 1,000 likes in order to, for every date that we created. And on the new version of Hinge, it was 50. And so dramatic, you know, 20 times more effective at getting people to a date.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, business owner, did you know that over 4.2 billion people are active on social media now? That means if you want to connect with your customers or find new ones, you need social. If you want to build loyalty and stand out from the competition, you need social. And if you want to make using social media easier, more impactful, you need Hootsuite. Hootsuite is the must-have tool for managing and growing your business on social. Hootsuite makes it easy to find your audience, whether on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, or Pinterest. You can schedule content, publish posts, and track your success all in one place. Millions of businesses around the world are already using Hootsuite to supercharge their social efforts. And now it's your turn. Go to hootsuite.com/HSH to start your free trial and get 50% off your first year. That's hootsuite.com/HSH for a free 30-day trial and 50% off your first year.
And our next sponsor.
As a business owner, you know what it's like to run a business from your inbox. I'll be honest, I completely run my company Amaze Media Labs off of my inbox. I imagine just like you, between the sales recruiting and fundraising emails, to name just a few, things get messy. Streak is this great CRM that is designed to help you stay on top of each part of your process and your inbox. And get this, without ever leaving Gmail. I love the fact that Streak allows you to set up pipelines right inside your inbox to start tracking your contacts and emails through each process. It also offers tools for email tracking and mail merges that can save you tons of time and scale up your efficiency. And nothing is more important to me in that Streak lets you collaborate by sharing emails and pipelines with team members from the office or remote. It's also amazing in that it allows you to access your pipelines on desktop or the mobile app, offering an opportunity to share information in meetings, at job sites, or however you work on the go. So sign up for Streak today at streak.com/HSH. and get 20% off your first year of their pro plan, their most popular option. That's streak.com/HSH for 20% off their pro plan. streak.com/HSH.
And we're back.
So it went from 1,000 likes to get to a date to 50 likes to get to a date. So that was our North Star metric. And so we were focused on that and not growth and engagement. But we believe growth would come if we were really effective at what we were doing, because we believed in word of mouth growth. We believed if people were actually getting out on dates, if they were finding their partners and telling people about it, then that would actually lead to our success. So we wanted to tie our success to our user success. And that was the bet. And so it was slow going at first, because word of mouth, it's a chain reaction, but it's exponential growth, but it starts very, very slow. And so it didn't look so great at first, and it was pretty scary at first. But then over time, now we're the fastest growing app in the US, the UK, Canada, Australia. It's because of our relentless focus on just being the most effective app.
Wow, that's amazing. And I know, so how did it happen? I guess Match.com and came knocking on your door. What was that process like?
It was a little bit of a scrappy process. So I actually, the relationship started because I was trying to poach their head of business development to come work in finance at Hinge. And that's how audacious I was. So then he kind of turned the conversation around and was like, you know, maybe we should actually consider an investment in you. And so that, I think, was when, it kind of clicked for me that maybe the opportunity here is actually to join up with Match Group and combine, I think, our passion and different perspective and their wisdom and considerable financial resources to really scale Hinge.
And how did that start? Did it start with an investment? I know there was, from what I read, a recent acquisition. What was, take me through kind of that timeline?
Yeah. So we relaunched the app in 2016, and it was slow going at first. And I went out and I tried to raise more money, but at that point, we'd burned through a lot of money. That $14 million I'd raised, like, we'd pretty much burned through all of that going through the development process of this new app. And we only really had money until the following September. So I had like a year to get this thing out there. And the numbers on the surface didn't look that exciting. Like, our growth just wasn't taking off yet. And so my existing investors were really incredible, and they offered to do an inside round, but it wasn't going to be enough money. I mean, like, it would get us 6 more months down the road, but it just wasn't going to really do it. And that was another big reason that the Match Group deal was, I think, so interesting to me. And the other thing is that Match Group had enough detailed insider kind of knowledge of what are the metrics we should really look for to know whether this is a diamond in the rough. And they did, and they saw that, and they saw the different approach. And so I think they had a special eye for knowing that we could really be valuable. So that, I think, is where that came from, that alchemy came from. And so they made an initial investment then with the rights to make further investments and then eventually to acquire in the future.
So they did acquire Hinge, correct?
Yeah, about 18 months after that first investment, they fully acquired Hinge at the end of 2018.
And what's that like for you? I mean, obviously, it's an incredible moment. At the same time, you're now working for a much bigger organization. How's that been for you personally?
Difficult at first, really difficult. It's my baby. It's still my baby. And giving up the control and giving up, that was definitely something I had to get my head around. But ultimately, I believe that it was going to be best for Hinge, the business, and for the people who worked at Hinge to be part of this bigger organization. And I was nervous because I had a lot of friends who were founders and sold companies, and it can go sideways a number of different ways, and usually does. It either, the company takes off, but the relationship with the founder goes sideways, or the company goes sideways because it's being mismanaged or deprioritized by the parent company. Or sometimes it's through no fault of your own, the company strategy changes or the CEO changes, and then like new strategy, and then they throw out your whole thing. So I've seen that happen. I mean, I would say 9 out of 10 times. So that was definitely on my mind that like there's a very good chance that this is not going to work out. And I really invested in the relationship. I mean, this is, I think, the big life lesson that I've learned through this whole experience is if you want a great relationship, you have to really work at it and invest. And I did, and they did. And now the relationship is truly phenomenal. I think that we have a really good working relationship. We built up a lot of trust in one another. And yeah, it's really hard to imagine. It's incredible.
I've got to end there because, no pun intended, I mean, we're talking about relationships at the end of the day, right? And they take work. And I'm sure you've created quite a few great relationships over the years through what you've built. And I wanted to thank you just for your honesty too, and just being so open and authentic. I think that's incredible, telling your journey from addiction through this success. And just wanted to thank you, Justin, for coming on How Success Happens.
Thanks for having me.
You got it.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.